When you think of leadership for the common good, I mean, Holden is a place where a lot of people come to reflect on sort of these hard issues, where together we seem to be messing up a lot, and yet nobody's in charge, really. I mean, who's responsible, right? It's really hard to sort of put a list together of how we're ruining our environment or when things aren't working right. So what do you think about when you think of leadership or sort of issues of the common good? What are key components of that?
I think of politics and government.
Okay. Are you involved with that?
I used to be. I spent 15 years in that before I got into my current field.
And okay.
It was a challenge. And I think I've been, after spending that much time in it, I became dismayed with the process, with the quality of leaders, the quality of the people we are electing to office. Mm-hmm. And I still continue to be dismayed.
Mm-hmm. Roger, what was your job?
I was on a congressional staff.
Okay.
For 7 years and 3 years. I also spent 3 years on a state party staff, and I also spent some time managing campaigns. The highest campaign I ran was a U.S. Senate campaign in South Dakota.
Okay.
So I had a fair amount of exposure to the process, and it was frustrating for me because I had a pretty high ideal going in, and I found that so many things were done just for the expediency of the office holder to stay in office, mm-hmm. things of that nature, where the real public good, the good of public policy was not being made based on what was really good for mm-hmm. the people. It was being made on what was good for the politician. Mm-hmm. And I still think it's that way today.
I was going to say, don't you think that's true?
Yeah. And I think part of that is the package that's there for the politicians is so rich that they become selfish and more concerned about maintaining their
so everybody has their price
life.
And
yeah. Well,
a lot of them have found home base.
Right.
Glory seeking?
Yeah, there's a lot of ego involved, but I think you have to have a strong ego to run for public office in the first place. So I guess I don't find fault with a strong ego, it's the corruption of the ego that occurs afterwards.
What else? What do you think of when you think of sort of these hard, complex issues?
when you talk about the political leadership and all that, and, you know, there's that certain, you know, where you're leading people, but, you know, what is it a selfish motive or is it a Christian motive? What is the good? And it seems like leadership is such a broad term that, you know, it's, you know, to say good leadership mm-hmm. or leadership for common good. I mean, everyone has their own ideas, you know, whether it be a politician or someone self-serving, you know, or, you know, as far as like power and riches and that sort of thing versus leadership where you're more Christ-centered, where you're leading people in a way that's, you know, very different from this world, but wanting to be inclusive.
And also in public life, everybody has different value systems, different religious beliefs, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so parts of the world are really struggling with that, right? And look at the Middle East, you know, and think of them resolving issues for the common good there. Very complex. Because even sort of the mention of a certain religious perspective creates a war, literally. And so that makes it even more difficult. What are other things that you see as sort of challenges to try to resolve some of these hard questions? Talking about leadership for the common good and kind of what?
Well, finding a common ground.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. So getting back to your point of what's the common and common ground. How do you find that?
Roger, were you suggesting that the politicians know where the common ground is, but sort of ignore it because other things are more attractive?
Some of them don't care what it is. Some of them do. I mean, there again, it's a mixture. I think far too few of them put that at the top of the list.
Yeah.
Too many.
Well, I think all sorts of things from, you know, like in my congregation, I'm just a layman, but in my congregation, you know, I can see that more of us need to take responsibility for leadership, and we're kind of, and I work in fundraising, and so I work with a lot of volunteers, and I can sure see that, you know, there's always doing better things I'd like to be able to figure out how to do. But then all the way up to, you know, I've been reading Thomas Merton up here some, and, you know, he was such an advocate for peace, and you think about my land, how can we develop? But it, so I, all sorts of things come to my mind when we mention these subjects, and we're talking here about a sustainable society, how do we develop leadership for that? With the church, there's so much potential for Christians in the world. So, I mean, I guess one thing I'm excited about is getting everybody to see that they're sort of a leader, mm-hmm. and to take more responsibility.
Mm-hmm. That's one of the main things. Everybody wants responsibility.
Yeah. Well, let me share with you and pick up on some of these things about, because as we've puzzled with this, I think that a lot of solutions are overly simplistic. And then we sort of sit in camps where we sort of like the ideas. So what we've been trying to do is to develop some kind of a framework that's helpful to people and groups and organizations deal with complex issues. And then looking both at the issue, and then how do you get some movement? And so a couple colleagues of mine in the center, Barbara Crosby and John Bryson, actually wrote a book called Leadership for the Common Good that was designed around some of the earlier work we'd done in the center, some of the work that John Bryson had done on strategic planning, and some of the research of a lot of public institutions around, primarily in the United States, of how do we effectively address some of these complex issues. And then we looked at it from the leadership perspective. Then how do we build collective capacities to do that? So some of this is not asking a question. It's really, we feel pretty strongly that there are some things that we can know in order to better sort of organize and approach a question. And so I'll share with you kind of the framework, and then we can discuss that. And it's really kind of a three-part framework, and right now what we're doing then is putting together a field book for people and organizations who might want some tools of reference as they work on their own issue to kind of figure out. Because I believe that the churches can't do it by themselves. So one of the things that we took a look at was the context itself that these issues occur in. And one of the things that we began to see is that a lot of resources A lot of the learning that a lot of us have had has to do with, in the church or with whatever, but it has to do with running an organization, right? Or group. Or community. Either formal or informal, but most of it's pretty structured. So we have rules and regulations for the village here, but it's self-contained. And it is hierarchical. We have three directors, right? But most in the United States, most organizations are designed this way, and most of the resources are to work within the organization. And we're pretty good about working on effective organizations. But the kinds of issues that we're talking about are what we've come to call messes. And this is the context that they occur in. And you've got all sorts of these little organizations, right? And you've got people and you've got groups, but there are just all sorts of things going on. And we don't know as much about how to effectively manage a mess that we do about an organization. So one of the things we began to look at then is this is what we call the need for a shared power world. Right? In order to get something done, we have to sort of organize our energy so that we're not on a collision path. And we think that getting outside of these things, we don't have as many effective tools. So that's one thing, is to get people to start thinking about the very nature of sort of messes. And to sort of embrace that rather than to whine about it. Because there's a real high comfort level of staying in our organization. At least we can control that. And so one of the things that we're doing is to see that no single person, you can organize a hierarchy, an organization, where a single person can kind of orchestrate things, right? But we're finding that messes, that's not the case. So it's no longer a debate whether or not leadership is singular or plural. That the mess needs leadership. You might be able to run an organization with a leader or a team of leaders. So that's one of the things we're looking at, is the importance of and really getting into this sort of mess-keeping context. To say that we need some different ways of thinking about that. The second thing that we started looking at then, so that deals with the piece of sort of the what is the common context. And it's really a mess is what it is, by design. Because nobody's in charge of it all, right? I mean, we don't have a system to be in charge. We have some systems that sort of link things. But there's a lot of stuff that's sort of open territory. Now, there's a lot of good news in that, too, because a lot of transformational change comes from outside of organizations, not from within. So there's a lot of evidence also that there are some opportunities you have in messes that you don't have in organizations. Because nobody thinks it's their job. Whereas in organizations, you have job descriptions. I mean, what's the job description to care for the messes? And whose responsibility? It raises all those questions. We're learning some about that here in the village. You know, but again, the village is self-contained. Right? It's easier to manage the village than it is to manage the region. Another thing that we started looking at, another component then in the framework, is that we had to agree that to a certain extent there was this kind of context, that it was a messy context, not an organizational context, that it occurred in that. The second piece then of the framework was to say it takes a wide range of capacities to deal with the messes. And then we started looking back at some of the work that we'd done earlier in our center and other people have done on leadership, the leadership literature, if you will, and developed a framework of what we thought to be essential leadership capacities that were needed in some ways to deal with leadership for the common good. And I'll just give you kind of an overview of what those are. But we needed to be intentional about building public leadership capacities. And that's an ongoing thing, you never arrive. You don't get certified. But as I describe them, you'll see how no person has at all any of those as well. So then the capacities, if you were sort of thinking of this as a model, the background of the model would be this: some agreement that there's a shared power world. And just kind of owning, fessing up to that. Rather than thinking we can transform that into an organization, I think we have to think about managing that world in a different way than we manage organizations. So I think for me, I'm trying to think of another way to kind of even think about the rhythm of that so that it can be in harmony rather than in conflict all the time. So then, getting back to that, then what are these capacities that we might need to build? Well, we came up with 9, and you could sort them differently, but just to kind of get people thinking that we work with about then assessing if you're going to try to work on domestic abuse issues. Okay, just take that as an issue. You've got families, you've got individuals, you've got organizations, advocacy organizations both sides, you've got public supported institutions that deal with the issue. I mean, all sorts of people, right?
State funding.
Okay. So then what kinds of capacities might be needed then to address, to put together a strategy, say, to address that? Well, one we would say is the leadership of knowing something about the context in which that work occurs. So it's informing yourself about understanding the social, the political, and the economic systems that would interface with that issue. So there's a lot of substance in understanding the systems that have something to do with that. And so our center happens to be located in the University of Minnesota, so we have access to a lot of resources, so that if we were all working on domestic abuse, we could invite in some people to help us understand how the systems work. We can invite in some families to tell us how they're both formal and informal systems, to try to understand the complexity of all the different threads that make up that system. So that would be understanding the issue in the context that it occurs in. Another one would be, another system would be the market system in the United States, because a lot of issues occur within a market context. So for example, in schools, I would argue are being really impacted by a market metaphor, because it's a system that we're overlaying on a lot of issues. So you have to understand how that works in order to deal with it, otherwise it's going to deal with you.
Even with public funding, you know, our state and federal, that's what, you know, as far as our economy goes, that affects the, what is the reality of federal and state funding.
So that would be one, what we would argue is that's a whole set of capacities, leadership capacities, to understand the context. Another one would be what we call personal leadership capacities, that we have to understand all the people involved, including ourselves. And sometimes if we don't have a good handle on ourselves, things backfire. So it would be understanding how I work and what's important to me and my own personal passions, but also understanding a lot of other people that are involved with the issue or need to be involved with the issue. So it's helping and understanding who has a passion about this issue, both for and against. It's not just an advocacy group that's for it, but who's going to understanding the other people that may be against the issue, that they're going to want to pull in the opposite direction. So, and understanding how that group works, understanding the metaphors that they use to frame the issue differently. So there's a lot of work to be done in that. So there's a whole cluster of activities and skills and all sorts of things. So that's the second sort of leadership capacity. Another one that we came up with was, we think that in this kind of work, you have to be pretty talented, or some people do, on learning how to organize teams and coalitions. And there's a lot of, so team leadership. A fourth leadership sort of cluster was what we call organizational leadership, which is how to nurture an effective and humane organization or inter-organizational networks and communities. Different from, come on in, the hierarchical organization. So it would, there's a lot of work going on now in terms of building learning organizations and cultures. So you see, you can begin to see how much you need to know in order to address these issues.
What did you call this one, Sharon?
Organizational leadership. But I think I would include in this cluster things that are taught in schools of management. I mean, how to run an organization, as well as sort of innovative work that looks at, say, how do you transform organizational cultures? Now, which is more difficult, more long-term. And so there's more work being done there. But ultimately, I think the design of sort of leadership for the common good in these complex issues call for a different kind of organization. And we unfortunately have, a lot of us have learned skills that fit quite nicely and effectively in a hierarchical organization. So when we get into these things, what we do is we care for our, it's easier and there's a higher comfort level to work within our own organization. And we always fall back on that. So we're trying to look at new ways of work to organize these work on these complex issues and to get people introduced to some of those. And a lot of it's custom design. It's based on the context. All of these are interrelated. I don't mean to say that they're isolated. Another skill is what we call policy leadership. I'll say more about that. But it's really, how do you frame an issue, get it set up, but so that we begin developing policies that relate to that issue. whether formal or informal. So norms in a society or culture or community, as well as rules. But in the United States and in most parts of the world right now, we're moving toward democratic forms of governance, where we have policies. And as you said, Roger, I mean, a lot of the work that's going on here is kind of suffering greatly, but it's still important. So we're doing some work to look at and work on specifically policy leadership, because some groups don't really know, and I'll say more about that, because that's another whole piece of the framework.
Is an issue similar to a mess? You're talking about framing an issue, is it like framing?
Well, a mess is the context that an issue gets plopped into. So the context, a mess is the context, which is lots of organizations, lots of people, lots of groups, lots of, you know, and there's no sort of rule of governance for it all. I mean, there are sort of general rules, but it's nobody's job. I mean, as we use up the world's resources that Larry has talked about over the last 2 weeks, whose job is it to do that? Who's in charge of that? And how do you lead that issue then? We're going to put together a plan to lead that issue. Even about environmental issues, I had 2 years ago, I was brought in as a consultant to the CIA. And they have probably the most sophisticated leadership analysis team in the world. They have 100 full-time people doing leadership analysis. Really interesting. They brief the president every morning, anytime, any scene. You probably know about this group. And they have been studying the Greens in Germany on environmental issues. And they crossed it off their list. They had analyzed the personal leadership of the people running the initiative, decided it wasn't going anyplace, and crossed it off their list. Well, my sense is that you got to watch the issues, not the people. But a lot of people have been conditioned to think about leadership as only what's in the individual. So another sort of cluster then of leadership work that we've looked at is this notion of visionary leadership, and I talked about some about yesterday about how you build a shared vision. But what's included in visionary leadership work is helping to create and communicate meaning in our visions. People buy into visions that are meaningful to them and fight against visions that aren't meaningful to them. So part of working on a public issue is to help co-create a vision that's meaningful, that people feel is important. See, how do we create a vision within the people of the world about maintaining the environment, environmental issues? So that's a whole cluster of just the strategy and the ways that we need to start working so that we all have the same picture. We all have the same understandings. And that it's meaningful. And then another cluster is what Roger talked about earlier, was this notion of you have to know something about political leadership. So that it's, you have to know how political leadership works. Because we are in a world where there are forms of governance, and for a lot of people it's not just how the government works in the United States, but it's how it works in other parts of the world. A colleague of mine in the Institute wrote a book called Leadership in the Global Commons, which is how do you manage issues when the weather. How do you know what the weather is when the weather goes over different countries? I mean, there are lots of sort of global, it's the same mess that you can think of in your neighborhood or your region about an issue. We have that same mess in the world. So part of what you need to know when you manage those is you need to know a lot about how political leadership works. And so how policies are being set and enforced differently around the world. A lot of human rights work. Those of you who have been involved with human rights violations around the world, you need to know a lot about how different forms of governance work and then how to interface with them if you're going to have any impact. So a lot of women's issues around the world are dealt with, and a lot of women that we work with are parts of systems where there are lots of work being done to look at how policies are set differently, say, regarding children. So it's how decisions are made, administrative decisions are made, how the democracy works, how a more controlled society works, but it's all of the above. But it's knowing a lot about the political leadership and knowing those. If you don't know those systems, I mean, I've watched too many community groups go in and not be understand how the system really works. I mean, you can look at it on a structure chart, but if in my county, if you go in to talk to a county commissioner when the rules say it's time to come in, you'll never get your project funded. Because you need to know how it informally works. And I'm interested more in reality than sort of theory. And so you got to know who the county commissioners are. You need to visit with them. You need to know who their staff are. You need, and it's a long-term, and so it's looking below that. If you're dealing with the courts, you need to know how judges work. And you need to know the protocol in the courtroom. And if you make mistakes, sometimes judges say, I mean, there are all sorts of ways that the culture of a political system works. And you need to know that. So that's another arena of leadership that we can work on to kind of know and to draw from, because that's another capacity, if you will, that in order to address these things that sometimes we're going to have to link into. And another thing then is what we call ethical leadership, which is sanctioning conduct. It's enforcing or reinforcing constitutions, laws, and norms, and helping to resolve residual conflicts, both employing formal and informal courts. Okay, so there's a lot of ethical leadership when the desegregation movement got started. There was some ethical leadership when a few people went and said, this is not okay. They did their homework and they said, kids that are African American are not getting the same education that white kids are getting. And the Constitution says, or the rule says, or the law says. And so they helped, they started saying, we're out of line here. So we define that as ethical leadership. But it's based on either policies or norms or laws when they get out of sync. But it's raising those up. And that's hard work, as you all know. Martin Luther King, you know, he started saying, well, things aren't right here, right? So I would sort of put him as having really good skills in that camp. But you all know sometimes people, I mean, I work with people from other parts of the world, and getting them involved with ethical leadership means really taking risks that they might not be alive tomorrow. I have a colleague in the University of Minnesota who was doing work on ethical leadership, and he had been interviewing heads of major organizations in the United States. And then he went to Central and South America and started interviewing some leaders there. And he came back and it sort of it transformed his whole life. I mean, he could hardly stand to be in the university anymore because the ethical questions involved with some of these hard, complex issues where the leadership means you may not be alive tomorrow is so different than whether or not you're going to get 2 million or 3 million if you cause a ruckus in your corporation. And so ethical leadership is very serious business. And so people need to think about that and think of strategies and alternatives so that they can do that work and continue to do that work. So that would be a whole other camp. Very
exciting. Would be an example.
Right, right. But also for any of us that when we start saying, say, doesn't our congregation have a rule, or doesn't our church have a rule about this where you don't have the votes, but in your soul you know it's not working right. And sometimes we label those people sort of troublemakers. I mean, very difficult work. So that's another camp of leadership. And then the last kind of camp of leadership that we call it the putting it all together. But leadership is all of the above plus some other things. So that you can't just isolate it and just say, well, now I've got it down pat. Now, what's the interrelationship of all those capacities? Okay, so part of our framework then for leadership for the common good is to build leadership capacities, but defined that way. And you can see that there are just hundreds of thousands of sort of angles that you can take on that, but they have to be then created and aligned with the particular project. And so what we're trying to do is create some resources so that as you're working on your sort of issue, you can kind of go through those things and figure out who's good at what you have good capacities about, but where you need to get up to speed. So it helps you focus some sort of how you align people and their gifts with the work that needs to be done. Now, can you think of sort of an arena? We don't have time this morning. We can get into any one in great detail, but that's just one component. But again, out of that, we've just come to the conclusion that leadership on public issues, leadership for the common good, needs leadership, not leaders, that leaders won't be able to do it. So we're focusing our work on building leadership capacities, working with a lot of people with a lot of different talents, because we think that no person can do it all.
And then the timing for this, so, at which point you define in kind of the what you expect to be the common good, mm-hmm. or what is the issue? Mm-hmm. Because you've got a lot of capacities here,
right.
But they can be working toward different goals or mm-hmm. toward, different objectives. Mm-hmm. And so there's got to be some point where you have some definition of what you consider to be the common good. I mean, environmentalists,
right.
Hey, we want to be able to
right.
our kids.
Thank you.
Kids.
Thank you. That's the next part of our model. And I mean, none of these are not linear, so they don't come in sequence. They all come together. So as you can see, this is just a draft of the workbook that I'm working on. But as you can see, the background, I mean, it's hard to get a visual of something that's holistic. But the background is this crazy mess of a shared power world. And then you have this thing that's kind of flying around. It's a model with all of these different components on it that are all important. And unfortunately, we try to make everything linear when it doesn't work that way. So one piece then is this leadership piece, where you have to build these leadership capacities. Another piece is what you're saying, which is we think that an important part of dealing with issues for the common good is to be very intentional about navigating some kind of a policy change cycle, what we're calling a policy change cycle, but it's how to set up the rules then, how to get some agreement together that we're all going to work on this. So how are we going to get some agreement that on domestic abuse issues or on environmental issues? I mean, how are we going to do that? Well, let me just share with you kind of some of the themes, the components that we're putting together. And, you know, this is changing as we kind of work with a lot, because a lot of people are involved in kind of talking and working with us on this.
You know, are you sort of, we want to move from shared power, you talked about. We need to move maybe to shared responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is that what your vision work kind of leads you to?
Mm-hmm.
So pretty soon we feel that we've got to work on getting the solution and not leave it to others
right.
or
right.
point our fingers or something.
And part of, if we had time to talk about just what is shared power, most people use that would be a component of shared power, is that responsibility piece. But let me suggest then what some kind of policy change or norms, which is less formalized. But it's this piece that a lot of people are really disgusted with the formal policy process in the United States right now. But we work with people from all over the world, which makes it even more complex. Last year, one of my colleagues was from one of the African countries where he was working in a situation. He was one of the inner circle And he was looking around the table one day and decided that all of the people around the table had a whole lot more money and resources than everybody else in his country. Which caused him to kind of do some other things. And then at the end of the year, he was appointed the ambassador to the UN for that country. But he had to be very strategic about when he spoke up or he would no longer be alive. So, I mean, these things are, I don't pretend to kind of understand them all, but people who work on these initiatives, it's just a lot of work to kind of figure it out. And so what we're trying to do is to sort of build a framework that's helpful to people to sort of organize their efforts a little bit more strategically. So on the policy change cycle, the first piece on this is what we call an initial agreement, or even to create the issue. So to a certain extent, talking about the environment isn't helpful. I mean, you got to give voice to the issue, and we have to sort of co-create together what's the issue here that we're going to address. And anytime we get into that, there's so many variations on the theme that it's to try to get the work focused. So then a piece of the policy cycle is the first piece is that you have to have some kind of an initial agreement that there's a problem and we're going to work on it. We're going to work on it together. We're going to figure out what we're going to work on and what we're going to let go of. Because anytime you get a lot of people, interested parties together, everybody sort of has a notion of what pieces of that are important. So it's even within that, finding some common ground. The second piece then is when we sort of decided, here's an issue that we need to get placed on the public agenda, which is that issue creation. See, I don't think that a lot of the environmental issues are really part of the public agenda right now. I mean, that's not step number one, is to get it out there to enough people to make sure that we've created this as a public issue. And a lot of times that involves very extensive educational work. So, I mean, I think some of the work that Larry's doing and that Daryl's doing is trying to educate a lot of people to kind of understand this and get the issue onto the agenda. So I see their contribution, their gift, is they're creating the issue. But second piece then is once you get it onto the agenda, then the second piece of this cycle of policy work is to get the problem, to get it framed as a problem or as an issue. So it's the framing of it. So how are we going to take this issue and frame it so that we can do something about it?
It seems that one reason why we don't get the environmental issue going is because so many people are on a survival level, even middle class. And if we could convince them that their survival will be much better, their economy, everything else, if they go in for this and demand it, and not to is to make everything worse. But right now they don't see where it connects with their survival. Every day, the survival they think the environmentalists are talking about is way in the future.
Right.
And they don't see specifics as to how it could be.
Mm-hmm.
Like the straw house.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how many people then could afford a house?
But these are, you know, it's all very complex.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to build them in such a way that a lot of people can do a lot of things that contribute, but not necessarily the same thing.
Mm-hmm. And you said the other day about making a problem statement, not stating it as a problem, but as a mission.
Right. So then part of this problem formation is to frame it as something we want to build. What do we want to build in our community where we can get excited about it? As opposed to feeling bedraggled. And that's come up a lot here in the village over the past few weeks as we've talked about environmental issues, because people get really discouraged. As opposed to getting motivated to say, well, yeah, let's do this. And we have a clear sense in our mind. So part of the next stage is to figure out what we're trying to build, but to frame that. Not just to get it on the agenda, this is an issue, But now what are we going to do about it? But to develop that sort of image of what we're going to do.
Yeah, this is the first time this year I heard the tailings piles problem of, you know, polluting the creek with asbestos and cyanide and that now it's being called a reclamation project.
So you see it's getting reframed.
Yeah.
But that's part of the framing and reframing. The
problem's still there.
And you know, a lot of these issues are long term. They don't get quickly. And if we frame it and it doesn't work, so we reframe it. I mean, in Minnesota, we had our drug czar that took issues of drugs. And she's a real creative woman, and she really worked with a lot of people and a lot of organizations and reframed the drug issue as a health issue. And a lot of things happened because of that.
It wasn't them, it's us.
Right. But she was really helpful in sort of leading that form of reframing of an issue, and that's a skill. But you know, different people can take on some responsibilities in different areas, but in this kind of project.
Is healthcare an example of an issue that kind of, originally we had this so-called healthcare crisis, and I think the issue was framed as being doing something about the uninsured, and then it became broader and broader. Recently we're trying to do something about all of healthcare, and it seems to have gone askew to me. Is that an example of something that was originally framed, but then became unframed,
exactly.
And now we have an
underpass? Exactly. And I think what happened was there was actually some work that was done to analyze that issue, because I've tried to track that. And the criticism came when the key sort of policy framers didn't do enough educational work to get everybody on board.
Even the
and
place.
So what happened is that the private sector and those in sort of the business of healthcare got way ahead of the game, and they did their education among their own advocacy groups. And the public never sort of got on board. They never framed it. We never knew how to think about it enough. And so, as a consequence, it just got railroaded.
Now it seems totally market-driven to me. Totally.
Yeah. That's what happened. But it's not a public issue anymore, either. It got taken off the agenda.
But I think it may come back.
But we've got to look at these things as sort of ongoing. You don't arrive.
Right.
That's part of this mess thing. Is that you can't control it, you know, and I mean, you know, look at years of failure.
I think we could solve the uninsured problem if it was stayed in that framework.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree with you, but right now, because of the market-driven forces, and I'm in that industry very closely, we have a major public policy issue that I hope to become very involved in, where insurers have turn this into a for-profit endeavor. Now, you know, in healthcare, there have been traditionally abuses. Nobody will dispute that. But the insurance companies are absolutely abusers, and the uninsured problem is going to grow to tremendous proportions if we let what is happening now with managed care continue.
So you see, any of these issues we could get into, then how do you reframe so that it's not just it's not what you're against, but it's a clear statement of what you're for. A lot of work gets into what we're against and what we don't like, and I started thinking about that for myself a few years ago when I spent a lot of time working with a guy by the name of Harlan Cleveland, and he was working on world peace. And I began to understand myself that I knew a lot more about what I was against than what building peace really looked like, so that I could get engaged. But that's part of that framing it. So that's another piece of that cycle. Another piece then is once you get it framed, then you have to do some work on saying, well, you got to start searching for solutions. So if you frame it this way, then how are we going to start working with the issue in order to address it and move beyond, to move it forward? So now how might you solve that? So it's one thing you get it framed. It's another thing then to kind of start coming up with creative ideas for solutions. Now those three pieces relate to another piece of the model. And I just want to mention this because we're kind of running short on time. So we've got sort of policy work in that change cycle that I'm going through. Then we have all of these camps of leadership capacities, right? That we talked about earlier, which is complex and rich and interrelated and whatever. And then we have sort of what I call the places that a lot of work, you need to know where the work happens. You need to know what room to go into, if you will. And what we're finding is that Barbara and John talk about forums, arenas, and courts as three primary places where some of this work gets done. Now, creating the issue in the initial agreement over here, framing the problem, and then trying to think of some solutions, that work usually and most effectively gets done in what we call forums, which are a lot of dialogue, a lot of people coming together, a lot of sort of getting the folks together working on things. Holden holds a lot of forums. This is the forum. We get together and we sort of talk about things, but you get ideas percolating. This is not a great heroic leadership sense. Do you see this? I mean, you got to get a lot of people going. These issues will not get solved by a great leader. That's why us looking to the President of the United States to kind of save us from ourselves, it's never going to happen. It takes so much more to begin to think about the complexity. So that forums are places where people come together and do some of this initial work, but it's very creative. It's like pottery. It's like an art form. It's getting a lot of ideas woven together. The next steps then here are, once you get a solution sort of identified, then you have to start doing some work on putting it together and framing it in a policy. You have to then, once you get those written, and Roger, it sounds like you've done a lot of work there in trying to help write up and frame policies. How do you get it set up so that we can sort of have it as part of the structure of our systems? Then, not only that, once you get it drafted, then it has to be reviewed. You have to get it adopted. Then you have to implement it, and you have to evaluate it, right? So you start saying, well, here are some ideas. So those three pieces are primarily done in the arenas, which is another piece in that. And you need to know about arenas. But that happens in certain places, so those get passed on. And then the final piece of the policy change cycle is you got to decide whether or not you're going to maintain the policy, or whether you're going to terminate it, or you need to adjust it in some way, and that happens in courts. So people say this isn't legal or right or fair. And there are a variety of different kinds of courts. We don't have time to go into all of that now. Barbara and John, we're talking about this because one of the courts that we talk about is the court of public opinion. You see, and how do you deal with your issues in the court of public opinion? But there are all sorts of courts, formal and informal. There are all sorts of arenas, formal and informal. But there are ways that, so in families, you know, parents are sort of the arena, they decide the rules. and they're also the courts, you know, at least kids think so. But you see how these play out, but you gotta know what room to take it in. Another, and some of the things that I have consulted on some of this with a couple people that from Minnesota, both of them have spent a fair amount of time in the legislature, and they're as elected officials, as policymakers, as policy designers. And sort of some things that they agree on is that when you start working with arenas, first of all, you have to know what you want and what you can give up. You know, I mean, going in there thinking you're going to get your way, but you have to be very strategic about that. You got to be organized, and you know that. You got to know who to work with, and other people who share your interests, and also people who don't share your interests. You have to get to know politicians, whether you like it or not. You got to get to know them. You got to get to know them well. and you got to get to know who knows them well. Because primarily there's a lot of consensus that they decide on people, not ideas. I was just over the last year spending some time in Washington lobbying, and the agenda is to cut the budget. Any other agenda item that you're trying to get on, that's why people are getting burned out. And the only way that's going to change is if the people say there are some other issues that are equally important here. It's really knowing the people. You've got to get, for an issue, you have to have a legislative champion. And whether it's in the court, in the system in the United States, or whether it's in the church, with the governance in the church that goes beyond a congregation. I mean, you can place this in a variety of contexts. And you have to know how the system is organized, formally and informally. So there's a lot to know. So we're kind of running out of time.
That last point you made, I mean, that's why it's very difficult often even at the presidential level, for somebody coming in from outside. I'm thinking Carter coming in, who hadn't been working with the legislators, didn't have the national connections in that sense. I mean, he obviously had to go to the people, but he didn't know who to work with or how to work with it, as opposed, I guess, to Johnson, who knew everybody and everything.
That's right. Different people work differently. Some elected officials in the United States, I think, in Congress, are getting out of the Congress because they don't want to work in that system. They think that there's a lot more for their own personal passions and interests. They'd rather get back into working with forums and getting people and helping take issues that they're interested in and help them get framed and get onto the agenda, and they want to help do that. But they feel as though there's some essential issues that aren't getting framed, that we're not working on, and they sort of know how that system works, but they don't want to work there anymore. They got there because they cared about an issue that they can't seem to get on the agenda.
The people who they can work with,
right?
And if they reframe it, then
right.
Important.
But they feel that they can now make a contribution in helping take some key issues that they're interested in and start getting them framed and even identified as an issue. I mean, how many people in the United States today believe that sort of environmental concerns are an issue? You know, I mean, Holden Village is not big enough to kind of save us from ourselves. I mean, there's a lot of work to be done.
Do you mind if I open up two doors?
No,
it's
please do.
In here. Environmental issues right here.
So do you see how, this is just a model, and you can design your own. But I think anytime we talk about sort of a public issue and leadership for the common good, it is very complex.
And we really haven't emphasized that you mentioned in the market, but the market has many more resources than it faces. Health issues and environmental issues and so forth. Many more resources that not near five
steps ahead. Well, but one, I'm a great believer that if you can get these issues framed up and get people understanding, everybody will bring their own resources, kind of loans and decisions philosophy. You know, we'll start looking around and start figuring what we can share. So we start whining about resources initially. I don't think it's a good place to start. If we don't have it framed, some of these issues is framed not just as my personal issue or a small group of us, but starting to say, let's get this onto the agenda for the common good. I mean, that's what I think, for example, I mentioned earlier, that's what I think Larry and Daryl are doing, is they're trying to get the issue onto the agenda.
And you'll never do anything if you start with resources, because there's always somebody.
Right. I'm just saying that it's got to be recognized, mm-hmm. the strength of that.
Right.
That doesn't mean you whine about it, you work another way, so that you can reframe it as apparently the drugs are, has reframed the issue.
Yes.
You're talking about getting it on the agenda. Are you speaking of the United States
any agenda, whatever agenda. I mean, maybe it's an agenda in the Lutheran Church. Maybe it's an agenda in, on Minnesota, we have a whole network of women's organizations called the Minnesota Women's Consortium. And maybe there's an issue, or, you know, maybe it could be any agenda. My two colleagues are now restructuring the UN that's been a year in our center that are out right now in New York helping. So there are many agendas. So I just think this leadership for the common good, you know, it's beginning to identify that context, a lot of things, sort of getting straight, and then sort of beginning to develop a broad spectrum of sort of approaches. But I think there needs to be a method in our madness. So what we're trying to do is to try to work with people and groups that have certain issues. They're trying to get on the agenda, and then they need to do their own design. So what we're trying to do is help build some frameworks that may be helpful for them to kind of think through their work and then begin linking to the right people. So does that give you a kind of a sense, a different way of sort of looking at leadership for the common good? It is definitely not this notion, well, we need to create a few great leaders, and then they'll just tell us what to do.
You mentioned a lot of the last components. You have a sense of where we typically are weak, where are we? We're obviously not doing this for most of the
day. Yeah.
Where do you think that most of the organizations, a lot of organizations are working on, are looking to make some fast improvement? Here's some facts where people tend to be weak, general ideas, and you know, they have an improvement. The feedback is a lot. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you're saying. I think it varies a lot. You know, sometimes your strengths can become your weaknesses. I mean, some public issues like education are so well organized that you begin to think, oh, this is the organization and I'm fine. You know, and so there's not a lot of work going on to frame new issues for kids. You know, I mean, how are we framing the issue that some of our kids aren't learning? It's getting restructured into more sort of work to sort of analyze outcome-based education. You know, maybe that's one way, but a lot of organizational stuff is we get good at one area and then we do more of the above, which maybe can do us in. I don't know. But I think it varies. And that's part of the work of leadership for the common good, is to get people thinking about where their strengths are and where they need to improve.
I think the internet's
going to
have much impact on all of this.
What do you think?
I think it will eventually. I'm not an expert on the internet. I use it myself. And I've been talking to other people. I mean, it seems like it's a whole new era of knowledge.
A communication tool.
Right.
It certainly helped me with some of my colleagues that are living in other parts of the world and dealing with issues where they're trying to link into things, and I can sort of partner with them by email. So if they're having problems or want access to something, I rush around and see if I can find. They're managing their own stuff. But
seems like potential is there.
Right. I mean, you can communicate across a lot of different organizations. Just saying, wow, let's try to frame this thing up. And, you know, most of us can't. It's too difficult to try to convene people. So get some conversations going. Any of you need to go ahead and leave because we've come over time.
Sure. And
thank you for coming.
Recently, I read two books. One is American Who Pays the Taxes, and I wouldn't have bought it had it not been written by Steele, who won a Pulitzer Prize. And the other was Democracy, Carrying the Weight of Our Democracy, People Called People. Now, that's not the exact title, because I can't remember the exact title. But it went on to state that when the middle class and lower middle class and lower class stop really voting, only those who are upper class and upper middle class will always vote. Mm-hmm. And when the politicians took polls, they realized through these polls that the only people they had to worry about then were the upper class for sure and the upper middle class, who would always vote. Mm-hmm. And they geared all of their thinking toward that. And so I
And of course, where did their contributions come from? So it seems that we've got to not just get people to vote again, but we've got to have campaign reform. That's at the bottom of all of it, because that decides on the budget, it decides everything.
Well, see, I would argue that it's even a lot more than that.
Yeah.
And if you look at the policy change cycle, a part of that has to do with elected officials. But a lot of other parts have to deal with other people. So I say that's important, but that's, I don't think that's going to solve all of the above.
I think that's true.
The other thing is that in the United States, poor people have always voted at lower rates. And I mean, that's part of our history in this country. Is that primarily the policies and the rules have been set by people that have more resources. If you look at voting rights in the United States historically, people who are poor and marginalized, you know, I mean, look at women starting to vote later. I mean, poor people, if you look at income levels and voting records, there's always been. So I don't know that that's new, it may be getting worse.
Do you think that's because they think they're not informed?
He went on to state that they gave up. It's not that they hadn't always been that way. He did mention in the book that always the middle class and so on were the ones who voted. But it got so that there were many more who weren't voting, who were just opting out, feeling it wasn't necessary. But those who had a lot to lose, a lot more to lose, became far more powerful and then contributed even more money as the political spectrum changed from grassroots. The grassroots didn't exist anymore. It wound up through these people who had, let's say, the 1.5% of the ultra-rich, who could hire lobbyists to go in then, and they were the ones who set the agenda and who really were formulating all kinds of bills. And the regular, according to the Constitution, the process was being changed. It was now being done by lobbyists, and our whole tax reform was that way. We got one time, I've talked too much.
Your point is an important one, but I also know that there are any number of initiatives that have been quite successful by groups that don't have a lot of money, but become their own lobbyists. So they can't hire one, so they create one. And you can learn how to be a lobbyist. You know, but you got to have your issues framed. You got to have your act together. Now, you know, getting back to this, why don't they do that? I think that being discouraged and losing hope and having faith that things can be different is an important thing. And I know my own experience, and any of you who have been in Washington recently, where the agenda, we have one item, it's to cut the budget. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is the driver, and a lot of people are getting discouraged about that, but we're going to have to recreate some issues on the agenda. So it's just going to, I think it challenges us all. I'm a big believer that I don't think it's, you know, to think about sort of just, am I a leader? I think I'm much more interested in working with groups to look at some of these collective issues. Let that become the driver, and then as we frame that, we think about the leadership capacities that we're going to have to build or link into or whatever to sort of put that together. But it's a different sort of approach to sort of leadership development.
One thing that you need to keep in mind, too, is when you do get these issues from the creative and on the forum, that things take time, much time, maybe as much as 10 years.
Or more. You're absolutely right.
So patience is absolutely essential.
You're absolutely right. So people come and go. You know, on the issues that necessarily, right.
I think one thing that really burned me up in reading this book, during the reading of it, was that both parties decided, it went along with the big companies that were the defense companies, and they decided that they could convince the American people that they needed to build defense. And even against the information in Russia that there was no need for any more defense, they threw millions and trillions of dollars into it
and that crystallized our society even more. And so 89% of the wealth of the profit is now going to about 20% of the people. And it wasn't crystallized like that before. It started very much during the end of the Carter era. Much more into the Nixons, much more and very much during Reagan's 8 years. To the point that when the time came and the Cold War had ended, we didn't have the money we needed to help make this, to help the Eastern European countries the way we needed to. And both parties, Steele went on to say, agreed that the American people would go along with this, and they were able to get money for their campaigns for this. So I'm really concerned about campaign reform for this reason.
So that could be an issue.
Yes.
About different people work on different issues.
Mm-hmm.
But even to frame that, I mean, I'm suggesting that this is a model that might help you because all of a sudden, you don't do that in one organization. I mean, you can apply that.
There
how
are,
you can frame
that there aren't any grassroots, but there really are some places where their grassroots are still alive and well.
And they're growing.
And they're growing. Mm-hmm. And I'm just thinking, I'm from Oregon, and we have an initiative process. I mean, we're going to have, I don't know how many initiatives on the ballot. They've raised enough. I mean, so it really is a culling out issue for period to vote. And that in itself is an discouragement to a lot of people to vote. But Minnesota has a strong background in having listening to the quite a few responsible people. There are certain places where, you know, machines have been so strong for so long.
Right. Well, or some of my colleagues who are working in other parts of the world, they're doing a lot of work on democratization, where you had a kind of a system. And so in this model, they're focusing to try to build forums because they have all been torn down. But there was never gathering places where people could come together and form issues and discuss issues. And, you know, and so it depends on the issue. It depends on the place in the world. You've got to custom design it to your work. We just did a video on this framework. And one of the cases that we did was the benchmarking project in Portland and Oregon as a whole.
Mm.
And then...
is it published yet?
Mm-hmm. I'd be happy to send you. You might want to look at it. But it's to try to show how this comes to life in an issue. So we took three issues to try to demonstrate how it might play out and the craziness of it. One was the benchmarking project in Oregon. The second one was desegregation in the school district. And the third one was mental counseling and business in terms of trying to create a different form of governance and how that played and brought worked on some of this cut across.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see.
Sharon, I really enjoyed this.
Well, thank you.
And I want to go back and write some notes down, some ideas that you gave me, because I really believe what you're saying is true.
But it's a different way to frame leadership, you know, and this is the work that our center's doing, trying to say, well, it's really complex, it's hard, it's long work, don't beat up on yourself, and it's going to take a long time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, patience is important.
And persistence.
So thank you for coming.
Thank you.